Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated March 27th, 2015. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's cover story, Drawn into Durham. Colorado couple Greg and Jane Hills and their celebrity partners, such as television directors Jay Sandridge and James Burrows, are investing in downtown Durham in a big way. This column comes from Amanda Hoyle. Down the street from the former bank building, where Greg and Jane Hills have staked out East Coast headquarters for their Colorado real estate company, construction crews have almost finished tearing down what's left of five historic buildings on Parrish and Main Streets in downtown Durham. Rubble is all that's left of a block of buildings that had once been part of Black Wall Street, a hub of African American business activity in the early 1900s, along with the Woolworths store where sit-in protests took place in 1960 during the Civil Rights Movement. The historical significance is not lost on Jane, although neither she nor Greg grew up in Durham. Prior to this project, the couple had few family or financial ties to the Bull City. Their intent was to save the facades of the remaining buildings and incorporate them into the storefronts of the 27-story, 300-foot glass tower that will be built on the corner site. Pressure tests, however, showed the structures would likely topple under stress. That didn't go over well with the Durham Historic Preservation Commission, but the group eventually gave its consent. In historic preservation circles, it has to be practically falling down already for it to be a lost cause, says Jennifer Martin Mitchell, an architectural historian and member of the commission who cast the sole dissenting vote. I felt like they were giving up on the buildings too quickly, but it's a done deal now. The Hills and their team have instead devised a plan to rebuild the facades once the tower is complete using the salvaged bricks. There's a lot of responsibility that goes with this building, Jane Hill says. Parrish Street's history is hugely important to this city, and it's a big part of our plans. The Hills have spent the better part of the past 2 years hashing out the plan for what will be the largest, tallest building project in Durham of the past 25 years, the $85 million One City Center Tower. Across the street, they are gutting and renovating the 1960s-era Jack Tar Motel Court that will also be used by tower residents for its existing parking deck. For the Aspen, Colorado couple, it's been a crash course on everything Durham, a city that neither knew much about beyond the 4 years that Greg Hills had spent at Duke University as a student athlete on the men's tennis team in the mid-1970s. But when their son Austin, for whom their real estate company Austin Lawrence Partners is named, was accepted into Duke's freshman class in 2008, the Hills did what they usually do when they go into a new city. They explore. They met Scott Selig, Duke's off-campus real estate executive, over breakfast one day at the Washington Duke Inn and Conference Center, where the Hills always stay when they are in town. Selig invited Greg Hills to join him in his SUV and drove them through the streets of downtown Durham, making note of which properties were most ripe for redevelopment. "Scott was right," Greg says. "We were intrigued by what was going on here." Shortly thereafter, they were introduced to Paul Smith, a partner at Durham's Greenfire Development, a company that had been buying up properties all around downtown Durham but was too undercapitalized to move forward with development when the recession hit. The Hills eventually bought two properties from Greenfire, including the One City Center Tower site and the 400 West Main Street Bank Building, slated also for redevelopment, and hired Smith to manage their Durham office. Chris Odell, vice president at Armada Hoffler Properties, a real estate firm that is also building projects in downtown Durham, says he's been impressed with the Hills' quick grasp of the local landscape. "They have a definite passion for Durham and a vision of what Durham can be," Odell says. "They seem to be very committed to that, and we think they are on the right track for what Durham can be." Armada Hoffler's construction company will be the general contractor for the City Center Tower. A return to his college town, however, was not on Greg Hill's priority list when, after graduation, he returned to his hometown outside of Boston, aspiring to play tennis professionally. When that didn't pan out, he instead pursued a real estate license upon advice from one of his tennis students at the local country club. He worked with a Coldwell Banker commercial affiliate in Boston for a while, but it didn't take much convincing for him to leave. "I loved real estate, but I hated being a broker." Hills instead reconnected with his former student, Martin Stone, then the chairman of manufacturing conglomerate Monogram Industries, who hired Hills in the 1980s to be his assistant at the company's Los Angeles headquarters. Hills had worked alongside Stone for 3.5 years. "It was like getting a master's degree in business," he said. Stone sold his stake in Monogram in 1983, and according to news reports, he and two other shareholders sold their 30% stake for $35 million. By that time, Greg had met Jane, an account executive at an advertising and marketing firm assigned to the Monogram account. The way Greg tells the story, she walked into his office on a Monday in October 1982. She was smart and beautiful, and he was too intimidated to ask her out. His nosy secretary called Jane after the meeting anyway to inquire. They were engaged by November and married in May. "It was love at first sight," he says. Shortly after the wedding, Greg and Jane Hills started their first real estate company with financial backing from Stone. Their list of private investors has since grown to include contributions from wealthy Duke alumni, Aspen Ski Resort regulars, professional athletes, and a few Hollywood entertainers. Earlier in Jane's career, the National Hockey League had been one of her advertising clients, and she's maintained many of the professional connections she had back then. The office in Durham is decorated with framed hockey sweaters from the Dallas Stars, Edmonton Oilers, and other NHL teams. "We've got about 150 signed hockey sticks by now," she says. While most of the ALP's investors remain under the radar, Jane confirms the list includes Jay Sandridge, who directed The Cosby Show from 1984 until its end in 1992, and James Burrows, the Emmy Award-winning director of the hit television comedies Taxi, Cheers, Friends, Frasier, Will and Grace, and The Big Bang Theory. "Most people like us who like to stay low-key," she says. The Hills' first commercial real estate acquisition was a rundown 270-unit apartment complex in Columbus, Ohio that was bank-owned and badly in need of repair. When Greg flew Jane in to see the property for the first time, she broke into tears. "It was awful," she says. "This was our first property. I didn't know what we'd gotten ourselves into." But once renovations were underway, Jane came up with the idea to add a hot tub as a new amenity for the property's residents. Hot tubs were a common commodity in their native Los Angeles at the time, but still a novelty in that part of Ohio. "I went around to the tenants and told them that I'd buy them a case of beer if they'd come and sit out in the jacuzzi when it was snowing," Jane says. When the snow came, so did the residents and a local television news crew. "About a week later, our units were full," she says. Their holdings grew to about 1,000 apartment units in the Columbus area their first year, and they expanded into California, buying up retail centers and more apartment properties. But after their two kids were born, Greg and Jane decided to leave L.A. for a more family-friendly atmosphere, settling on Aspen, Colorado. They also sold all of their remaining commercial assets in Ohio and California. In Aspen, available property is scarcer and in higher demand. Medium home prices are around $4 million, so the projects the couple began to pursue, Greg admits, were smaller in scale than projects they had tackled before. Renovation and restoration of historic cottages, development of new mixed-use buildings with a large loft residences, and conversion of apartment properties into condominiums. The Hills' own chic loft condominium, recently featured in Traditional Home magazine, is less than 2 blocks from the gondola that takes skiers to the top of Aspen Mountain. With son Austin now graduated and working in the family business, and daughter Whitney a junior at Duke, Greg and Jane Hills have been spending more time at their home away from home at the Washington Duke Inn. Greg also volunteers on a task force for entrepreneurial students at Duke, and Jane is a member of the Athletics Leadership Board for Duke's Athletic Booster Club. They visit for a few days every 2 or 3 weeks to keep up with the Durham projects, and Jane says they are thinking about taking one of the upper-level apartments in the One City Center Tower once it's completed, even though Greg says he's afraid of heights. The tower and hotel projects are now, for the most part, on track, Paul Smith says, and digging for the 2 levels of underground parking will begin in April, and steel for the superstructure should be coming out of the ground by fall 2015. The tower should be open for its first residents in 2017. Duke University is committed by taking 55,000 square feet of the building's 130,000 square feet of office space. Durham City and county governments have agreed to grant $7.9 million in financial incentives over the next 15 years if both the tower and the hotel projects are completed within a certain timeline. City Center is going to be a world-class, iconic building. It will make a statement, Jane boasts. It has to. This is our family legacy. This week's column on real estate by Amanda Hoyle starts with an interview with Commerce Secretary John Sclavara. North Carolina Commerce Secretary John Sclavara, in his address to the Triangle Business Journal's Power Breakfast event in Raleigh on March 19th, had plenty to say about North Carolina's economic development accomplishments and challenges, despite having been in office less than 3 months. Sclavara served 2 years as Secretary of the North Carolina Department of Environment and Natural Resources before being transferred to lead the Commerce Department on January 1st. At Diener, Department of Environmental and Natural Resources, it was like Niagara Falls pouring into your office all day, every day, and it was always bad, Sclavara told the crowd. At Commerce, it's like Niagara Falls pouring into your office every day, but there's actually good stuff in there. There's optimistic stuff. There's fun stuff. We're making things grow and watching the economy and helping grow the economy, Sclavara says. First question. JDIG, J-D-I-G. Our current program is called JDIG, Jobs Development Investment Grant. And candidly, the name itself digs us into a hole because in looking at what it's called and reading the way it's generally reported, everyone assumes it's a scholarship, he says, noting that the program should be rebranded as Jobs Grow and be refunded. Its cachet is currently depleted. Everybody believes that the rich counties are benefiting at the expense of poor counties. Nothing could be farther from the truth. It's a reimbursement program that collects money into the Treasury that we otherwise did not have. This is new tax revenue from the jobs we didn't have before. Next, on the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina. Mr. Sclavara is quoted as saying, I'm very optimistic. I equate them to being the starry-eyed young world beater who thinks every deal is a good deal. I'm supposed to be the gray-haired old guy who has learned a couple of lessons that not every deal is a good deal and ultimately determine if we should give money to these corporations. It's a great bifurcation, he says. So far, it's an A+. Next, on competition with South Carolina for manufacturing jobs. We have several disadvantages and disadvantages. South Carolina has become formidable. They call themselves the manufacturing beast of the Southeast. They're tough and they made a decision 20 years ago to become a manufacturing powerhouse. We didn't. Their JDIG program has no cap because they realize it returns money to the Treasury. What are our advantages? Number one, we're North Carolina. We're better than them. We've got things they don't have. We have, candidly, a more available workforce right now. They have kind of run the well dry on workforce. We have 4 megasites available right now that are potentially available to accommodate aerospace and automotive and so forth. If we had our incentive program, we'd have another arrow in our quiver. And on the Senate leader's stance on eliminating tax credits. It's a philosophical divide, he says. If the Senate has its way, there are no tax credits. They believe that a pure system without incentives and without credits based purely on broad-based tax is the thing that is going to work in the end. You flatten the base and you increase sales tax, and no income tax is the ultimate lure. I don't know if that's the right answer or the wrong answer. Continuing on Amanda Hoyle's column on real estate, Cary's Parkside Town Commons adds to its list of restaurants. A new Noodles & Company restaurant will be opening March 30th at Parkside Town Commons Retail Center in West Cary, bringing New Development's list of open establishments to 16 tenants. Parkside Town Commons to date has 11 retail and service store locations, including Target, Harris Teeter, Field & Stream, and Golf Galaxy, with three more shops scheduled to open soon. With the addition of Noodles & Company, Parkside Town Commons has five restaurants open for business, including Tzatziki's Mediterranean Cafe, Uncle Matteo's Pizza Joint, Tijuana Flats, and Jersey Mike's Subs. The restaurants that are coming soon are Toby Keith's I Love This Bar, Brick's Wood Fired Pizza, Chick-fil-A, Five Guys Burgers and Fries, and Menchie's Yoga. There's also a trendy woman's store opening at North Hills. Lily Rain, an e-commerce retail seller of eclectic women's clothing, jewelry, and accessories, has signed a deal to open its first North Carolina store in Raleigh's North Hills. The store will be located near Firebird's restaurant and should be open by the summer. And for commercial real estate, there's been a problem solved. The Sigma Chi sells their HQ campus and RTP to a charter high school. Sigma Chi, the International Scientific Research Honor Society, has sold its 52,000 square foot building and 12-acre headquarters campus in the middle of Research Triangle Park to a charter school that was slated to be displaced. A subsidiary of Research Triangle High School has paid $6.2 million for the campus and expects to have moved all of its classrooms from the nearby 10 Park Drive complex by the spring of term of 2016. Sigma Chi will be moving into leased office space nearby, says Interim Director Jasmine Shaw. Next up, Technology by Lauren Onisorge. Jim Goodnight takes a leap into biotech with a new investment. Jim Goodnight is taking a big bet on an Irish investment firm with Elan Pharmaceuticals roots. The billionaire SaaS CEO is among the backers of Malin, a newly formed Irish medical investment group, raising more than $350 million in a public offering. Goodnight's Reedy Creek Investments LLC has taken a 13.9% stake in the firm, according to a public filing. Reedy Creek's primary focus has historically been on real estate investments, but the firm deviated from that plan once before, investing more than $450 million in fiber optic firm Connexion. That bet didn't pay off as the firm liquidated in 2012. Connexion, founded in 2002 by former Cary Mayor Glenn Lang, had aimed to build fiber optic networks to reach homes across the nation, but when residential construction declined, the company went into bankruptcy. Malin plans to use the offering proceeds to fund a select number of companies in the life science industries, including Durham-based Viamet, according to a public filing. Viamet recently withdrew its IPO offering and raised $60 million from an investment syndicate, including Malin. Malin also is investing in Durham dermatology research firm Novan. Neil Hunter, who co-founded Durham's Cree Incorporated, is one of the founding investors of Novan, says Malin will become the largest shareholder of the company, which now has raised more than $60 million in five rounds. In each of the rounds, we have ascended in valuation, Hunter says. Glaxo veteran Bob Ingram holds a board seat at Malin. Ingram also sits on Novan and Viamet's board. Malin, which was formed by ex-Elon execs, counts among its other backers former Siemens CEO Peter Loescher. Next up on Lauren Onisorge's column for technology, Dude's Solution, Grow. Cary company acquires software firm and plans new hires. Nearly 1 year after announcing an investment windfall of up to $100 million, Dude Solutions is acquiring and hiring. The firm is acquiring Toronto-based senior living-focused software firm Windmill Software Incorporated. The move means Windmill's flagship senior living operations software, the Works Hub, which provides operations applications for more than 650 senior living communities in North Carolina, joins the Dude Solutions portfolio. Deal terms were not disclosed. CEO Kent Hudson says the firm reached out to Joanne Kemke, president and founder of Windmill, around Thanksgiving after an internal study showed the senior living segment was ripe for growth. "We just picked up the phone and called them," he says. Dude Solutions was just above the 200-employee mark in February of 2014, had committed to expand its headcount by 100 last year. As of March 23rd, the firm was at more than 400, including 380 at its Cary office. "I think you're going to find us around 500 at year-end," says Hudson. Dude Solutions is the Cary-based parent company of School Dude and Facility Dude, and provides operations management software to education, healthcare, government, commercial, and membership organizations. Its financial backer, Warburg Pincus, has $35 billion in assets under management and has a portfolio of more than 120 companies. And a shutdown. Emrise Corporation closing Durham facility in anticipation of liquidation. Emrise Corporation, a publicly traded manufacturer of defense and aerospace electronic devices, is shuttering operations. The Durham-based firm has entered a stock purchase agreement with an affiliate of Data Device Corporation to sell its issued and outstanding shares of its subsidiary, Emrise Electronics, for $44 million in cash, net debt, and a $1.3 million escrow meant to fulfill any shortfalls in working capital. The sale is expected to net proceeds of about $11 million and has already been approved by the company's board of directors. Additionally, the company announced it is winding down its affairs, having adopted a plan of liquidation and dissolution. Under the mergers and acquisition column, Apia could give new parent company a big revenue boost. Apia, a Durham app marketer that was recently acquired by Austin-based firm Digital Turbine, could give its new parent a big push. Digital Turbine envisions doubling its revenue in fiscal 2016. New predictions released via securities filings have the firm anticipating its combined revenue to be in the range of $110 million to $130 million for fiscal 2016. Filings also show how the previously private Apia has fared over the past few years. Under Jason DeBruin's column of pharmaceuticals, Glaxo to lay off 180 employees in North Carolina. Drug giant GlaxoSmithKline announced another round of layoffs March 23rd, this time affecting 180 workers in North Carolina. The affected positions are in sales, marketing, operations, and other managerial, technical, and support roles, according to a worker adjustment and retraining notification, known as a WARN notice, filed with the North Carolina Department of Commerce. Just last week, GSK announced 150 layoffs in Pennsylvania. Last year, GSK announced plans to lay off 900 workers from its operations in Research Triangle Park, though a significant portion of those are expected to find work with Parexel, a pharmaceutical research organization with major operations in Durham. The restructuring is intended to improve operational performance and contribute to a multi-year cost savings initiative across our commercial operations, global support functions, as well as the R&D and manufacturing facilities, according to the WARN notice signed by Lisa Bennett, GSK Vice President of Human Resources. Affected employees will be offered severance, though the WARN did not go into detail. Also under mergers and acquisitions, Salix executives grab $78 million in golden parachutes when Valent deal closes. When Valent Pharmaceuticals International buys Raleigh's Salix Pharmaceuticals, two former executives will make out with a combined $39 million in golden parachute compensation. Those payments will come to former CEO Carolyn Logan and former CFO Adam Derbyshire, who both resigned in the wake of inaccurate quarterly reporting that led to an investigation into wholesaler inventory disclosures and accounting concerns by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Logan retired January 30th. Derbyshire resigned November 5th. On March 16th, Valeant Pharmaceuticals increased its cash bid for Salix to $173 per share, or $11 billion. The golden parachute payments are factored based off that latest offer. Valeant had offered $10 billion for Salix in February, but rival drug company Endo International overbid Valeant with an offer that combined cash and stock consideration. After Valeant upped the cash bid Monday, Endo withdrew its offer. The deal needs to be approved by shareholders, and Salix expects it to close by April 1st. On sports business, also by Jason DeBrun, which ACC institutions rack up the most revenue during March Madness? Well, the best month for college basketball fans is March. While teams battle it out on the court, the Triangle Business Journal compiled a list of which institutions in the Atlantic Coast Conference generate the most basketball revenue. Using data reported to the U.S. Department of Education, the TBJ ranked the teams in the ACC by most revenue generated by the men's basketball teams. The disparity, it turns out, is rather wide. For this ranking, revenue means all revenue attributable to the intercollegiate athletic activities. This includes revenues from appearance guarantees and options, contributions from alumni and others, institutional royalties, signage and other sponsorships, sport camps, state or other government support, student activity fees, ticket and luxury box sales, and any other revenues attributable to intercollegiate athletic abilities. Number one is Louisville at $40.6 million. Number two is Syracuse at 29.8. Number three is Duke at 27 million. At the far end of this revenue generator is Notre Dame at $3.4 million. That's a pretty widespread for the ACC revenue generation during March Madness. And which Triangle team's NCAA tourney will generate millions for the ACC? Wins by Duke and NC State and UNC aren't good only for schools' morale and team spirit. It also means millions more for the ACC. The NCAA distributes money to conferences based on the success of their member teams in the March Madness tournament. Because five ACC teams advanced to the Sweet 16, which is an impressive feat in itself, the conference will receive millions spread out over the next 6 years. Each line on the tournament bracket represents one unit. As six ACC teams qualified for the tournament, that represents six units for the conference. All six teams won their respective round of 64 games, so that represents another six units for the conference. Add in the round of 32 wins, and the ACC now has collected 17 units. For each unit, the NCAA pays the conference between $260,000 and $297,000 per year from 2016 to 2021. So already the ACC will receive $4.4 million next year and more in subsequent years. It has long been the ACC's policy to distribute all revenue, either from the NCAA, football bowls, television deals, or anything else, evenly, so all 15 teams will share the money. And here's the March Madness by the numbers. This is an exercise in March Madness mathematics. Total different bracket combinations, 9.2 quintillion. 1 in 2.4 trillion is a realistic chance of getting a perfect bracket, according to Duke University mathematician Jonathan Mattingly, because you can safely assume all four number one seeds will advance out of the first round. And the estimated lost productivity in America during the Thursday and Friday of the first weekend of the games, $2 billion. We love our sports. This week's Executive Voice interview is with Mr. John Palmer. Mr. Palmer is a co-founder and chief technology officer of Power and RF at Cree Incorporated. When Raleigh native John Palmer co-founded Cree in 1988, he was a self-described propeller head from NC State University whose work experience had been limited to pizza delivery, bus driving, and grocery store work. Today, he's the chief technology officer for the 5,500-employee global public company based in Durham. Triangle Business Journal asks the question, when you and your co-founders launched Cree, did you have a clear idea of the direction you wanted to take the company? And has the mission changed? Mr. Palmer, we had a pretty clear idea of what markets we wanted to hit with our technology from the beginning. There were four basic markets we wanted to address. 1. Blue LEDs. 2. Power devices. 3. RF power devices. And 4. High temperature devices. We dropped the idea of high temperature electronics fairly quickly because the market was pretty small and very diverse. We stayed focused on the other three businesses, and that is still pretty much what Cree does today. TBJ, have there been any surprises over the years? Mr. Palmer, we never would have believed you if you told us that we would be selling LED light bulbs back when we formed. We did look at it fairly early on, and the efficiency and cost were so far off it was just a laughable idea. As we improved the technology and made further improvements in efficiency and reductions, it became less and less a crazy idea. The development of using a yellow phosphor on top of a blue LED in the late 90s to get white light further reduced the cost versus using a red and green and a blue LED to make white light. It finally began to look like we had a legitimate shot at LED lighting in the early 2000s, so we decided to go all in on the lighting market by selling white LED designed specifically for it. Eventually, we then started selling our own lighting fixtures for indoor and outdoor, and more recently started selling the LED light bulbs that many now know us for. TBJ, in what areas and technology do you see the company growing most in the next 5 years? Mr. Palmer, it's no longer a question of if, but when. LEDs will become the default lighting choice. Our mission at Cree is 100% LED adoption, and we continue to innovate to deliver breakthroughs that accelerate this goal. Market studies estimate that worldwide revenue for LEDs for general lighting will grow rapidly from approximately $6.5 billion in 2011 to more than $75 billion by 2020. In addition to LEDs, Cree's power and RF, radio frequency, business units have grown at a double-digit rate in recent years, and we remain optimistic about the growth potential going forward, given largely untapped market potential. TBJ, you've been actively involved in the Power America Consortium, which was announced more than a year ago. What's the status of the consortium's innovation plans? The program has been taking a long time to get going. Part of the issue is that it is a large program with 25 or so different entities involved. The Department of Energy and North Carolina State University spent a lot of time working with the various partners involved to shape and reshape all of the different efforts so that they come together as a coherent plan. All parties have their own ideas on what to do and their own set of motivations, and it just has taken a lot of time to get it all aligned and organized. NC State got under contract with the Department of Energy a few months ago, and now they are working to get everyone under subcontract to NC State so that the real work can get started. TBJ, what is the company's greatest challenge today? Mr. Palmer, our greatest challenge is reinventing an entire category and shifting fundamental thinking in a 100-year-old virtually unchanged industry. TBJ, so what's the next step? Mr. Palmer, at Cree, we take about 60 seconds to celebrate a victory before we challenge each other for being 60 seconds behind, obsoleting that product. If we don't continue to make products more effective, we will not hit the goal of 100% LED adoption. Cree is propelling the industry forward by educating the consumer base while fundamentally improving the commercial and residential lighting experience with technology advancements that lower upfront customer costs and further improved payback bring LED to price parity with incumbent technologies. TBJ, what do you enjoy doing when you're not working? Mr. Palmer, I have a place at the beach and love to go there and relax on the porch and watch the ocean. I still try to do a little surfing now and again or do some fishing down there. I also really enjoy shooting basketball with my son. I go to pretty much all NC State football and basketball home games because I have been a lifelong Wolfpack fan. TBJ, when you were a kid at Fred Olds Elementary, did you have an idea what you wanted to be when you grew up? Mr. Palmer, in the kindergarten time frame, I wanted to be a mailman. This was, of course, long before I realized that most of what the mailman brings is bills to be paid. But I thought it would be a great job, walking outside all day, bringing joy and excitement to all of the neighborhood houses. TBJ, if you hadn't gone into your chosen field, what would your dream career be? Mr. Palmer, honestly, it's been a dream career for me to be doing what I've been doing. I still have enough fun at it, and I'm challenged enough by it to keep at it. TBJ, what's your favorite kind of music? Mr. Palmer, I listen to a lot of alt music, blues, and grassroots rock. New Orleans-inspired Cajun Zydeco rock is a favorite as well. Next up, small business from James Lee. Mr. Lee is a professor at UNC Chapel Hill and a family business author and advisor. His column this week is entitled, Addressing Perceptions of Inequality in Family Business. You know, I really thought I'd done it right this time. My friend Clarence runs three successful, healthy menu restaurants that he's built out of his mother's little 60s vintage San Francisco coffee shop. But that rainy afternoon, sitting hunched over a bowl of veggie chili, he looks like he'd just lost his last bean sprout. Cheer up, Clarence, I say. You've done a lot of things right, including hiring a cook who knows a whole lot about making chili. Yeah, thanks, he says. But I'm talking about organizing things so my two kids and my brother's son can work together in this business and get ready for the next owners. That's where I've really screwed up. What are you talking about, I ask. Each of them is an assistant manager in one of your restaurants. They're bright, energetic young people with great futures in the business. Well, they might be all that, but they're sure not happy right now, Clarence says. As you suggested, I put together a scale for paying all three of them and giving them promotions and raises based on how well their restaurants do. For example, my son Tommy puts in 60 to 65 hours most weeks, and his restaurant clears about 20% more profit than the other two restaurants. My brother's son, Jack, is just as capable as Tommy, but his restaurant is smaller. He doesn't put in as much time, and the profit is proportionally less. So Tommy gets more salary than Jack, and Jack complains. He says if they're going to be equal owners of the business in the future, they should be treated equally now. Don't tell me. Jack thinks you're favoring Tommy, I ask. You bet he does. Clarence runs his spoon through his chili, and at the same time, Tommy hollers that he's working harder than the other two put together. Then there's my other kid, Karen. Her husband, Rob, who knows zip about the restaurant business, keeps telling her she should be a manager instead of an assistant. He says a female assistant manager is just a glorified waitress. So she comes up to me and demands to be moved up. No matter how I try, I can't please anyone. I know it's uncomfortable for you, I say, but at least they're just griping at you instead of fighting among themselves. That would not bode well for management teamwork when they take over responsibility for the company. What's going on here could be a perception of inequity, among Tommy, Jack, and Karen, and it's a fairly common problem in family businesses with several members of the younger generation moving up in the company. Perception of inequity? He asked. You mean they think I'm doing something wicked? That's inequity, Clarence, and it means that each of them thinks that the others are getting better treatment, a better deal, more money, or some other privilege. A perception of inequity usually results from not really understanding the business strategy or the succession plan, and having a spouse whining backstage just compounds the problem. Sounds like it's a time for serious family business sit-down. Clarence pushes his bowl aside and stares at me. So what should we do? Take a day off, I say. Just you, Tommy, Jack, and Karen. No other family. Make it a business planning retreat at some comfortable place where you four can work undisturbed. If you need a facilitator, I'll recommend one. But you should concentrate on clearly explaining your strategy for succession, for training the kids, giving them increasing responsibility as they're ready for it, and eventually moving them into top leadership as you move out. Waste of time, Clarence says. We talked about all that a couple of years ago. Maybe so, but it looks like nobody's really got the message, I say. It's important to be systematic in explaining the strategic reasons for the compensation formula. for the uneven workloads and the time they have to spend as assistant managers. Answer their questions honestly and don't be afraid to take their suggestions for improving the plan. And that would take care of this inequity thing, he says. Inequity, Clarence, I say. There are no magic bullets in family business management, but a little clear, honest discussion never hurts. On other news, the Cary Jaguar dealership celebrates a quarter of a century. Jaguar Cary is celebrating 25 years as a Jaguar franchise in the Triangle area. The Raleigh market is the fourth fastest growing market in the United States, and with all this growth, Jaguar has become a very important factor in our market, says Marty Stapleton, general manager of Jaguar Cary. Last March, we completed a new, much larger dealership to accommodate the increase in sales. Jaguar has a network of 164 dealers across the United States. Orange County hotels win national awards. Five Chapel Hill Orange County hotel properties recently received national and international recognitions. Hampton Inn and Suites Chapel Hill Carborough Downtown, Deal of the Year Award for the Hampton Hotels brand. Sheraton Chapel Hill Hotel, Richfield Hospitality, Top Performing Guest Service Hotel Sales Excellence Award, Sales General Manager and Director of Sales of the Year Award, all for Richfield Hospitality. At the Siena Hotel, there's an autograph collection by Marriott. Top 5 Overall Guest Satisfactions for Americas. Number 1 Staff Service Overall for Americas. Marriott Service Excellent Award. One of 12 hotels received for all Marriott Full Service brands. And AAA 4 Diamond Rating for Hotel, the 19th year. And Il Palio Ristorante, the 25th year. The Carolina Inn, a destination hotel, won a Forbes 4-star rating for the Carolina Crossroads Restaurant, 15th year, and AAA 4 Diamond Rating for Hotel, the 18th year, and Restaurant, its 13th year. Number 1 guest survey scores across the entire Destination Hotels collection, Number 1 urban hotel among Destination Hotels collection, and the Franklin Hotel, a Curio collection by Hilton, Number 1 guest service scores among the Curio collection. Baker Roofing wins National Firestone Award. Baker Roofing Company received the 2015 Master Contractor Award from Firestone Building Products Company, a manufacturer and supplier of commercial building products. The Raleigh-based firm is one of 256 out of a network of 3,000 Firestone licensed contractors to earn the designation for roofing system excellence. Baker Roofing is also one of only 16 firms to receive the Inner Circle of Quality, President's Club, and Platinum Council Awards from Firestone. This week's column from the opinion page, the editor's notebook, is from Sugata Mukherjee, the editor of Triangle Business Journal. His column this week is entitled, Talk to Folks That Know About Historic Credits. I get it. A dilapidated building at the city or a town's core has no buyers, developers, and investors. A development group comes in, promises to change it into a beautiful mixed-use property with offices, retail, and residences. In return, they ask for federal and state help to defray some of the development costs. Sounds reasonable, right? Yes, but there is one little glitch in the argument. Do we really need that development if only tax credits from the U.S. government and North Carolina make it financially feasible? So I went and talked to a few bankers in town who make these commercial development loans. They say state historical preservation tax credits play a small role in determining the project's feasibility. What banks are looking for is a sound business plan that will result in getting its money back with interest. We all know how happy these banks were from 2008 to 2013 when they saw their real estate portfolio balloon because people were unable to make payments on their loans. Currently, a bill to restore the historic preservation tax credit is moving through the chambers on Jones Street, with more than 120 House members signing on to the bill as co-sponsors. Under the new rule being discussed, the credit will be capped at $4.5 million for income-producing properties such as mixed-use developments and $22,500 for non-income producing structures such as houses. In all, the maximum liability for the state each year would be $8 million. Between 2007 and 2013, North Carolina allotted $106 million in state income tax breaks to property owners, developers, and investors of historic properties, or an average of $15.2 million per year. Remember, many of the same developers also got federal tax credits for those projects. Revenue officials say the credits represented $840 million in building improvements, a figure Governor Pat McCrory and many lawmakers have argued would be much lower had it not been for the tax credits. Their point is not without merit, but because the state credit number is often so low, it is hard to believe that those projects would not have happened without the subsidy, especially since the federal tax credit is still available. I'm not sure cutting back the preservation tax program is really the answer. Lawmakers should talk to people who finance these projects and ask them about the importance of credits. If, in fact, they come back with the answer that an elimination of such tax credits would thwart redevelopment, they should expand the program, not cut it. Put the new rules in place for 2 years and then review the projects. Then decide whether to scrap it for good use or use it extensively as an economic development tool. This week's guest column is from Shannon Joseph. Ms. Joseph is a business litigation attorney with Morningstar Law Group and a former North Carolina Superior Court judge. Her column is entitled, "Don't Freak Out If There's a Business Dispute." You may believe that a significant business dispute will never happen to you. In some ways, a lawsuit, whether by you or against you, is a little bit like a serious personal injury. When it does happen, it derails important plans and goals. It takes money, time, and focus to solve the problem and get back to real life. Always, this is money, time, and focus that you had planned to devote to other efforts. Fortunately, there are ways to get you back to business sooner and with less pain than you might otherwise suffer. As both a judge and a business litigator, I have had a front row seat at various tables in the courtroom for all manner of business disputes. For better or for worse, the courtroom shines a bright fluorescent light on three correctable errors commonly made by businesses dealing with a dispute. Do not put it off. Evaluate early and evaluate often. Do not let the moments pass you by. You can see them clearly in hindsight. In my experience, you certainly can see them from the front of a courtroom and from the jury box. You can see all those moments that went by when there was a chance to gather the facts early and take a long, hard look at what the costs, risks, and benefits of a lawsuit would be, and to prevent the dispute from escalating or, at a minimum, better deal with it. Early dispute evaluation will save you time and money, but it requires an upfront investment. It requires gathering enough facts to identify your strengths, your weaknesses, and the unknowns. A critical part of this process is to make sure that your business culture allows people to admit when they are not perfect, that they could have done something better, or that they, in fact, made a mistake. You want your team to feel comfortable bringing to your attention potential problems before they are actual problems. Missteps and mistakes do not stay hidden once a dispute erupts. It is better to find out the truth early, when you can avoid some of the natural repercussions that may flow from a misstep. Learning about a misstep is also an opportunity to make changes that improve your future success. Number two, do not wait until the doorbell rings. Keep the house tidy. Technology is great, except when it is not. The ability to store massive amounts of documents and information without occupying more than a thumb drive of physical space tempts you to never clean out your data closets. Being able to fire off joking emails that may be funny at the expense of a customer or a joint venture partner may seem like a great way to lighten a heavy workload. Do not succumb to the temptation. A lawsuit often requires you to look for all and produce all documents or all emails with about a broad sweeping subject. Be deliberate in talking with your employees about the proper use of email, whether you do that through a policy or otherwise, and develop a document retention policy and follow it. Number 3, do not get mad. When I was serving as a trial judge, I got a lot of great advice from some of the best judges. Among the wisest admonitions was, do not get angry until after you have spent a long time deciding to get angry. Of course you're going to get angry. Just don't write or say anything while you're still mad. Or write whatever you want, but don't decide to send or keep anything until you are done being angry and can read it when calm and, mostly importantly, cool. On top of that, when the other side behaves badly, and doesn't it feel like the other side always behaves badly? Remember that it is just business. Let the other side violate the do not get mad rule without reacting in kind. Judges and juries can see which side has consistently well-behaved rationality and which side is pretending to behave well only when they think the decision maker is watching. Often when the facts are complicated or murky, as in many business disputes, authenticity can be the plainest thing in the room. Here's something different. The Triangle Business Journal took a business pulse survey last week, and the question was, which of North Carolina's top attractions in the Triangle is your favorite? There were 759 responses, and they are in descending order: North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, North Carolina Museum of Art, Marbles Kids Museum was the third choice, Museum of Life and Sciences was choice number 4, Duke University Chapel, and then following last is the North Carolina Museum of History, with the top attractions in the Triangle. Carpenter Park and Cary will include memorial to plane crash victims. Citizens of Cary, town officials, representatives of American Airlines, and loved ones of victims of flights 3378 and 3379 and survivors of Flight 3379 were on hand for the March 24th groundbreaking of Carpenter Park in western Cary. The 16-acre park, expected to be completed in 2016, will be home to the privately funded memorial for American Eagle Flights 3378 and 3379 that crashed in Cary in 1988 and 1994. Carpenter Park is about 1 mile from where Flight 3379 crashed. Park features will include a community garden, pickleball courts, a central pond, children's play area, basketball court, terraced lawn area, a preserved forest, a pedestrian trail, and a picnic shelter. The groundbreaking was a time for celebration, for healing, and for sharing our collective past to make a strong future, says Mike Bajorak, the assistant town manager. The total estimated project cost about $3 million for plan, design, and construction. Funding was approved by Cary voters in 2012 as part of the Community Investment Bonds referendum. Here is the latest hype about Triangle communities. Number 10, Raleigh is the 10th best city for first-time homebuyers, from the Smart Asset magazine. Number 15, Raleigh-Cary ranks 15th for the highest rent growth in the nation from 2009 to 2014, from Realty Track. And number 25, Raleigh is one of the 25 best places to retire, according to Forbes magazine. Aladdin Gala nets $144,000 for a pediatric care unit. More than 300 guests enjoyed food, festivities, and entertainment at the Carolina Club on March 21st at the 3rd Annual Storybook Gala to benefit the Ronald McDonald House of Chapel Hill. With the theme, A Whole New World, the event featured Aladdin-inspired decorations, characters, and food and raised more than $144,000. UNC President Tom Ross and former UNC Chapel Hill sports announcer Woody Durham were among the guests at the gala, which included silent and live auctions, a jewelry pool for Kendra Scott Jewelry, and a raffle sponsored by Diamonds Direct Crabtree. Planned expansion of the Ronald McDonald House of Chapel Hill will facilitate the Loving Hands program, the only pediatric hospice and palliative care program in North Carolina. The expanded facility is expected to open October 10, 2015. We are so grateful for all the supporters and volunteers who helped make this event a resounding success, says Elizabeth Hollander, Director of Special Events at RMH Chapel Hill. Even on a night when the Tar Heels were playing in the NCAA tournament, we were able to draw a very lively crowd to support this wonderful cause. Next up, hospital chiefs spar over rankings. Wake County's top hospital executives sparred with each other a little at a Business of Healthcare symposium hosted by the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce on March 24th. While introducing himself, Steve Burris, the newly named president of Rex Healthcare, touted that Rex was recently named the number one hospital in North Carolina by Business North Carolina magazine. I'm not sure what their criteria is, but we certainly agree with them. Sitting directly to Burris's left, Wake Med Health and Hospital CEO Don Gitzig chimed in. Well, that same magazine also picked Crimea to win the war, he said, as a crowd, including Burris himself, laughed. Duke Raleigh Hospital President Dr. David Zayas also participated, although he didn't lob as many jabs as did Burris and Gitzberg. While all three hospitals compete, Rex and Wake Med have historically seen each other as more direct rivals. Speaking of rivalry, Kinston Chef snags three Beard nominations for the PBS show A Chef's Life. The James Beard Foundation on March 24th announced its list of restaurant and chef finalists for the 2015 awards, and a local television chef snagged multiple nominations. PBS host Vivian Howard, chef at the Chef and Farmer in Kinston, scored a nomination for Outstanding Personality Host. Howard also snagged the television program on location nomination for PBS's show A Chef's Life. The show was also nominated for visual and technical excellence. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.